The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
Today, we talk to Seth Klein. Seth is the author of the book, A Good War, Mobilizing Canada for the Climate Emergency. The book is a hopeful one. Seth argues that if Canada mobilizes for the climate emergency in the same way we did for World War II, we can take the large steps science tells us we need to take to address the climate emergency. In our chat, we talk about what history has shown that our government can do when it puts its mind to it, how we can address both inequality and the climate crisis, and what an emergency mobilization would look like. Here's Seth. Seth Klein, what a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Nice to be with you.
Seth, you, in your book, compared Canada's climate crisis and mobilizing it for it to mobilizing for World War II. Why the comparison and how does that serve us?
Well, I sort of stumbled into the comparison. As you're alluding to, my whole book is structured around lessons from the Second World War. So the first reason is that that was the last time we mobilized across all of society and completely transformed our economy in the face of an existential threat. And so I think there's lots of lessons to be learned. I didn't initially plan to structure the whole book around the Second World War. I set out to write a book that was going to tackle, well, what do we do about this harrowing gap between what the science says we have to do and what our politics seems prepared to entertain? And I was only ever going to have a single chapter on lessons from the Second World War because I'd long been intrigued about that as an example of rapid economic transformation. But the more I delved into the research, the more I saw more and more parallels, and I ultimately decided there was actually a lot here with a lot of lessons across a lot of domains, and actually a hopeful story, a reminder that we've actually done this.
Well, hope is good. We like hope. And in terms of illustration, what does that look like? Just give us a brief, give us a couple of concrete examples.
Particularly what it looked like in the Second World War as an example of that?
Let's start with that. That's a good idea. What it looked like in the Second World War and what it could look like when mobilizing for a climate emergency?
So first of all, I mean, I start from the premise that what we are doing so far on the climate emergency isn't working. We're not treating it like an emergency. We have been spectacularly unsuccessful in actually lowering emissions, provincially or federally. And then I can contrast that with the extraordinary transformation that happened in the Second World War. So just to give you an illustration, I spend a chunk of time looking at this incredible ramp up of military production in the war from a base of almost nothing. So before World War II, Canada was producing basically nothing in the way of armaments or ships or military vehicles or planes or any of it. And in the space of those 6 years, Canada produced 16,000 military aircraft, ultimately creating the fourth largest air force in the world, about 700 ships, 800,000 military vehicles, more than Germany, Japan, and Italy combined. Even in our little province, just to give a more local illustration, again, you know, there had been a shipbuilding industry in British Columbia back in the day. It had all gone dormant during the Depression. You had a couple, you know, shipyards in North Van basically doing repair jobs. In those 6 years, from that base of almost nothing, British Columbia built over 300 ships. You know, here we are in a province that we can't even seem to build a single BC ferry anymore. So that's an illustration of what I mean. And so then when I'm, and an interesting piece of what, of how we did that, I mean, we gave lots of contracts to the private sector, but we created 28 crown corporations during the war. So we created new economic institutions to get the job done. So I take those lessons and I think, okay, well, what would that look like today as we face down the climate emergency? What would a new generation of crown corporations look like that would allow us to ramp up production and distribution of the things we now need to decarbonize and electrify everything, whether it's wind turbines or solar panels or electric buses or electric heat pumps or what have you, because we're not right now. doing those things at anything close to the scale of what's required. I don't know if this is helpful, but I've done lots of interviews since my book came out, and you know, interviews are, people are always saying, like, how do you know when a government actually gets an emergency? And so I've just tried to distill this 400-page book down to what I see as four markers of when you know that a government gets it, that they're actually in emergency mode. So here are the four markers. One, they spend what it takes to win. Number two, they create new economic institutions to get the job done. So instead of trying to encourage other people to do what needs to be done, you just get it done. Third, you move from voluntary and incentive-based policies, which is so far all we've had on climate, to mandatory measures with clear near-term dates. And fourth, you tell the truth. You tell the truth about the severity of the crisis and what's going to be required of us to rise to that challenge. And when you think about those four markers, Canada did all four of those things in the war, big time. Interestingly, I would say, you know, our federal government and to a large extent our provincial government also hits all four markers with respect to the pandemic, another emergency. And with respect to climate, neither our federal government nor any provincial government in our country hits any of those markers. It's not that they're missing some, they're not hitting any of them.
So maybe, Seth, I'm sure you've heard this question many times, and I'm sure it's on the minds of our listeners, which is, well, that's all well and good, and we know the climate emergency is here, but the government can't do anything if the public's not on the side of a climate emergency. Mm-hmm. So, and you had an entire section in your book about public opinion.
Yeah.
So where do we go from here? How do we get this point to the point where politicians will do it?
So the first thing I would say is that the public deserves more credit from our politicians. The polling that I conducted with Abacus Research for the book shows a population that's actually ahead of our politics in terms of understanding the emergency and in terms of their preparedness for bold action. When I polled people on what I would consider true bold actions, which is to say things that go well beyond what any federal or provincial government has so far done, you know, I find levels of support that are all solidly in majority territory. So I actually think the public is increasingly there. But the other thing, you know, I, because of this exercise I've been through, I bring everything back to World War II. And, you know, interestingly, in the rearview mirror, we assume, you know, Canada declares war September 1939, and everyone was on board and ready to rally. And you know what? That's not true. People were not all ready to rally. The public was not all on board. People were extremely reluctant to engage in another world war not long after the previous one. And it actually took leadership to get the public on board. It took a lot of work and a lot of leadership. And it was ultimately, you know, that was ultimately successful. So I'm always interested, whether it's the war or the pandemic or now climate, you know, what's that alchemy of events and leadership that changes the zeitgeist so that we actually are in emergency mode. But the key thing about the leaders we most remember from the Second World War, you know, in response to your question, is that they didn't meet the public where they were at. They took the public where they needed to go. And that's what leadership in emergency means.
So you talked about a number of things. And first, let's talk about the public, where Canadians currently stand with climate emergency. You talk about how there is support for bold climate action. But I remember from your book that there was also a fair amount of support for the sense of Canadians want it all, where mm-hmm. we want bold climate emergency, where we also want to support, I believe, the oil and gas sector. So is there that naivety there that we're trying to combat?
Well, there's a lot of confusion is what there is. I'm really glad you've raised this point. My poll revealed the good news, if you will, about people's understanding that there's an emergency and readiness for action. The truth, though, is that the level of basic climate literacy in Canada is appalling. only about half of the public understands that the main source of global warming is the combusting of fossil fuels. I mean, that's pretty basic, right? So if you don't get that, that means when your leader, like your prime minister, tells you, we can take bold climate action and double down on tar sands expansion, you're like, well, why not? Okay, sounds good to me. And why wouldn't you say that if you don't understand the connections? And that's why I highlight that fourth marker. We need our leaders to tell the truth. And part of telling the truth is boosting that climate literacy and being forthright, as our Second World War leaders were, that the crisis means we're actually going to have to wind down those fossil fuel industries over the next 20 years. But in the absence of that kind of leadership, you can get the very same people saying, yes, I want bold climate action, and I want to support the expansion of the oil sands. And it seems surprising, but it's not actually surprising. And I think one of the arguments that I'm making is we need our leaders to impart a message with ubiquity and consistency. So when like our federal government declares climate emergency motion in the House of Commons one day, as they have done, and reapproves the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion the very next day, as they did, that's confusing. Or I don't believe we should continue to allow fossil fuel vehicles to advertise, right? That's confusing. We don't allow tobacco advertising because it's bad for our health. So why, what is it, there's a kind of cognitive dissonance at play when we tell people on the one hand that we have to take bold climate action, and yet we continue to allow this kind of messaging.
Seth, given that public opinion and climate literacy is fairly low, I also want to ask you the question or the point that some other people bring up, which is that, and that you have as well, that maybe we don't need to get the public there before we take action. Maybe we just take action and leaders bring the public along at the same time. One, is that possible? And two, is that democratic?
Well, I wouldn't quite say it the way that you did. I think it's mixed. So first of all, what I'm saying is that a majority of the public is ready. They're waiting. And you saw that reflected in the last federal election, where a clear majority of Canadians voted for parties wanting to take bolder climate action. It was, of course, dispersed across four parties, but it was there nonetheless. The point that I'm making isn't that you don't need public support, but I'm certainly saying you don't need unanimity, and you will never have unanimity. And I actually think a lot of what we've seen from our federal and provincial governments is this desire to continue to appease the fossil fuel industry, right? They actually are trying to land on a climate plan with which the industry will sign on and grant their approval. And I'm saying that's nuts. At this late hour, any climate plan with which they are comfortable isn't worth having. And we should stop appeasing them. But I also think there's a bit of magic at play, right? Like, think about past big regulatory changes where a minority of people would have pushed for banning cigarettes and smoking in restaurants and bars, or for mandatory seatbelt laws. And you would have initially had a lot of resistance, but there was enough pressure for the government to act, to legislate. And then, you know, with remarkable speed, those changes just become the new normal. And I think we're going to live through that again.
The next topic I want to touch on, Seth, is inequality. You link it in the inequality in the book very strongly to climate action and say that without social justice, it would be hard, if not impossible, to bring about climate justice. Can you unspool that a little bit for us?
Sure, happily. Yeah, so there are lots of climate policy purists out there who are like, don't link this to social justice, don't link this to inequality, don't make it any more complicated, it's hard enough as it is. And I respectfully disagree with them. I think, first of all, they're linked because they're linked. The richer you are, the higher your emissions. And the poorer you are, the more vulnerable you are to climate impacts and climate policies, whether as an individual or a household or a community or a country. And so these things are inherently linked. But the main argument that I'm making is that they need to be linked because that's how we win. Because if you don't link it to inequality and don't mitigate the regressive impacts of how this is all unfolding. Then you get a kind of right-wing populist backlash, right? Then it just feeds the Trumps of the world who present climate as some elite exercise from imposed on high. But I also, and again, I'm drawing inspiration again from the World War II story. The object of the exercise here is to mobilize all of society. And for that, you need social solidarity. And our leaders actually understood that in the Second World War. So our first key large income transfer programs were introduced in the Second World War. Unemployment insurance in 1940, the family allowance in 1944. The Marsh Report, which was this historic commission that laid the groundwork for all of the post-war welfare state, was written during the Second World War and offered back to Canadians as a pledge and a promise that the society they would return to would look different than the one they had left behind. That's how you get everyone on the bus. That's when you start to hit the enlistment numbers that we ultimately saw in World War II. That's when people started to rally. And I'm convinced that's true today. And that has its echo in the Green New Deal, right? This linkage of tackling climate action and taking climate emergency action with tackling inequality.
Seth, could you give us an example of a policy at a federal level that would be representative of an emergency type of policy?
Well, let's take both of those in turn. Let me come back to my four markers. Spend what it takes, create new economic institutions, move to mandatory measures with clear near-term dates, and tell the truth. So federally, what does that look like? Look at the contrast on spending for the climate emergency versus the pandemic. In this pandemic, we have seen what's possible, right? The federal government has taken on a deficit this year, well beyond what's necessary for climate, by the way, of $350 billion. The Bank of Canada has financed most of that. The Bank of Canada has bought $5 billion a week in federal government securities from March until just a few weeks ago, and now they've lowered it to $4 billion a week, right? Contrast that with Justin Trudeau making climate commitments to spend about $5 billion a year on climate. So they're not just spending a little less than they should. They're spending less by a huge order of magnitude. And much less than Biden is now proposing to spend, by the way, relative to our size of our economy. Create new economic institutions. So I mentioned in the war, we created 28 new crown corporations. Justin Trudeau has created two new crown corporations in his time in office. The Canada Infrastructure Bank, which is basically a vehicle for privatizing infrastructure, so far hasn't accomplished much. You know what the other one is? It's the Trans Mountain Pipeline. It's the one that makes us all the proud owners of a 60-year-old oil pipeline from Alberta. So, you know, I propose in the book a 3-page list of potential new crown corporations to mass produce and deploy what we now need to drive forward in the face of the climate emergency. Moving to mandatory near-term dates, I think we should ban the sale of new fossil fuel vehicles by 2025. BC is proposing to do that by 2040. So good that they're taking a mandatory measure, but the date's all out of whack. The date doesn't communicate emergency. Or you do what Vancouver has done, which is you say no new buildings will be able to use fossil fuels for home heating as of next year. Again, the BC Clean BC plan says all new buildings will be net zero carbon zero by 2032. So Vancouver, which has an actual climate emergency plan, is doing that more than 10 years earlier, or about 10 years earlier than the provincial target. And you tell the truth, which we haven't seen because the messaging is so confusing. So let me switch gears to municipal then. Vancouver, and of course I should say, you know, we should say for your listeners that I'm biased in this, of course, because my wife is Vancouver City Councillor Christine Boyle, who introduced Vancouver's climate emergency motion and who's been driving much of this. There's been a lot of municipal climate emergency declarations passed across the country. The truth is most of them are just symbolic, aspirational statements. Vancouver's is a real plan. I think it's one of the most ambitious plans in North America. And I think it can lay claim to being a true climate emergency plan. They're proposing to spend $500 million on the plan, which is a lot for a municipal government. They are starting to create new economic institutions. That's one area where it's probably weakest, but you see like the neighborhood energy utility, right? That's an example of a new, and they want to expand that. But the truth is that a municipality has limited ability to do that. That's where we need new public agencies provincially and federally, or with TransLink or things like that. There's a whole bunch of new subsidiaries I'd love to see BC Hydro take on that would make it much easier for the city to move its plans forward as well. Are they moving to mandatory measures? Well, yes, I was just mentioning that, right? No new buildings as of next year will be using natural gas for heating. That's climate emergency. And they have a plan that's telling the truth. They have a plan that aligns with the IPCC targets, and it's saying to the population, this is hard. We have to lower emissions by 7% a year for the next 10 years to meet these international obligations. And I don't hear the province or the federal government saying that as forthrightly.
Seth, probably my last question for today is, I'd love to hear about, now that you've gotten our listeners all fired up about taking emergency climate action, what are the next steps that you see that you're taking that you think our listeners should take to move government to an emergency mode?
Well, the first thing I would say is that this moment is political. I mean, part of what I think has slowed progress on climate is that so many of the solutions have been individualized, right? We're told what we should change in our own personal habits and lives and, you know, light bulbs and all of this. That's all incremental stuff. The next 10 years is all about speed and scale. And we can only achieve speed and scale at the rate required when this is state-led. And so this is inherently a political project now of getting true climate champions elected to office at all levels, demanding from all levels of government true climate emergency plans. It's worth remembering that before the pandemic, momentum was really building, right? I mean, we had 1 million people on the street September a year ago with the student-led, the youth-led climate strikes. We saw solidarity actions in support of the Wet'suwet'en February after that, in a manner that I think is pretty unprecedented in Canadian history. So the wind was in the sails. And then the pandemic, stalled things out to a certain extent. So I think we need to recapture that. But mostly, I would invite people in the pressure. There's lots of people saying to their politicians, we need climate action. I would invite people to use those four markers. And you can find them on my website. I have them, I'll link to them at sethklein.ca. To make clear, we don't just want, you to say long-term targets like carbon neutral by 2050 and these aspirational statements. These are the four markers that tell us you get it. That's what we're looking for.
Are you hoping for our listeners, Seth, to write letters, to get on the streets, to protest? What are you hoping for?
Well, it's
for?
All of those things. I mean, it's communicating directly with our political leaders as letters and phone calls and meetings. It's definitely taking to the streets as we can. It will increasingly mean civil disobedience. No great social movements that I can think of have ever succeeded without some form of peaceful civil disobedience. Again, we were starting to see that globally and in Canada pre-pandemic. And I think, we will increasingly see that again. Divestment is part of it. And it's something all of us can do in our lives because the institutions in all of our lives are invested. our municipalities are invested, our churches and faith institutions are invested, our universities and post-secondary institutions and pension funds and so on are all invested. So this is something we can all do to stop the money pipeline.
Seth, thank you so much for your time today. And I know that all of our listeners look forward to seeing the work that you continue to produce and also the action that would be hopefully happening on all three levels of government.
Thanks very much.
Take care, Seth.
Bye-bye.
That was Seth Klein. Seth is the author of the book, A Good War, Mobilizing Canada for the Climate Emergency. We talked about how Canada can do it, how Canada can address the climate crisis if we mobilize in the same way we did for World War II. And that's our show for today. You're listening to The Pulse on CFRO, your super local morning news show here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. Give me a shout at Meixi@coopradio.org. That's Meixi@coopradio.org. Thanks so much for spending your Friday morning with us. Ciao. Take care.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.